Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is proud. Well, it's been a little while, but we do have quite a few patrons and donors worthy of honor and praise, and this is an episode where it's kind of worth doing it. So let's do it. First up, let's do the donors. We have Demetrio, holder of 3.14159 hostages, who has increased his donation, and he shall now be known as Demetrio, holder of 3.14159 hostages and lord of 2.71828182849945 herds of enchanted cattle. Next up, patrons. We're going to start with Bishop Michael Lightfoot, Crosser of the Royal Tulips, who has made donations in honor of the immortal soul, and is now a cardinal. Cardinal Michael Lightfoot, Crosser of the Royal Tulips. Congratulations on your promotion. Okay, now then, we have Thomas, who shall be known from henceforward as Duke Thomas, holder of several strong opinions. Next up, we have a listener who is known as Christine Pizan, who shall be known from henceforward as Lady Christine de Pizan, patron saint of Burn Tracks and president of the Henry IV Fan Club. Next up, Evan, who shall be known as Jarl Evan of the Stylish Wainscoting. Next up, we have Cat, who shall be known from henceforward as Lady Cat, the final tiger of Wolfsburg. Next up, we have Daniel, who shall be known as Earl Daniel, the unrelenting trier. And finally, we have Fernando, who shall be known as Lord Fernando, Archdeacon of the Royal Model Train Collection. Congratulations to Thomas, Christine Pizan, Evan, Kat, Daniel, and Fernando for joining up. Your services to the realm are honored and appreciated by all. If you would like to become a donor or a patron, head over to the website, Wittenberg to Westphalia podcast at weebly.com. You know, it's in the show notes. Go to the show notes. And you can go to the support page, and all your options are there. And if you would like to make a non-monetary contribution, of course, reviewing the podcast is always appreciated on whatever platform you use. Also, telling people about it, giving us signal boosts on social media. On social media, I am on Twitter. I am also on Blue Sky Social, which I kind of prefer. It's a lot nicer there. So everyone go over to Blue Sky. You don't even need a code now. Well, of course, we've got the Facebook groups as well. So I hope to see everybody in the social medias. Okay, and with that, let's get on with the episode. Finally.
Oh, that my head were waters, and mine eyes a fountain of tears, so that I might lament. Might lament not the destruction of a captured city, not the captivity of the base populace, not the loss of my own property, but the death of the august Emperor Henry, who was my hope and my only comfort. Nay, more, to say nothing of myself, the death of him who was the glory of Rome, the splendor of the empire, the light of the world. Henceforth will life be joyous to me. Will there be a day or an hour without tears? Or shall I be able with you, most cherished friend, to speak of him without weeping? Behold, as I write what unbearable grief has dictated, the tears fall. The letters are wet with my weeping, and the eye washes away what the hand writes.
Quote from The Anonymous Life of the Emperor Henry IV, as translated by Theodore E. Monison and Carl F. Morrison, as read by Jerry of the Presidencies of the United States podcast. Check out his show.
Everyone's right and no one is sorry. That's the start and the end of the story. From the sharks and the jets to the call in the morning.
Greetings. My name is Benjamin Jacobs, your host as we travel towards Wittenberg and Westphalia, the wars of the Reformation. This is episode 96, another morning throner. Today we are at the point where we transition from the speed run of recent events to the start of the actual narrative, something I've been saying for episodes now. As such, please excuse an extended review of all that we have covered this season, a speed run of the speed run, if you will. In the last few episodes, we discussed the political situation in Rome, where politics were extremely complicated but had their own logic that was ignored only at great peril. Principal to this political situation was the fact of the papacy, whose de jure political and economic importance made it the key MacGuffin for the other actors to fight over, principally the aristocratic families of the city, and notably at this point, the Tusculoni and the Crescenti. Much of our time spent with the popes has involved power struggles in which these families attempted to get their own family members or preferred candidates on the papal throne. However, it wasn't just power politics involved, and it wasn't just the Roman aristocrats tied up in these struggles. The ideological justification of the importance of the papacy within Christianity meant that the papacy was more than just a local bishopric. This helped prevent the aristocracy from simply stripping the bishop of power, the way the local leaders had in many other cities. It also meant that the clerical hierarchy had a potential to have its own voice in city politics. Though in practice, by the time we're talking about, the clergy had mostly come to align itself with the aristocratic families in the city. This ideology also meant that forces outside the city felt they had a stake in the papacy. The outsiders most obviously involved in terms of our story were the German emperors of the Romans, who justified their rule largely on their relationship with the papacy, and much of whose administration was in the hands of clerics of the German church. But we should also acknowledge that over the course of papal history so far, the Eastern Romans, the Ostrogoths, the Lombards, and the Franks had acted in some way out of a desire to use the papacy to secure their own legitimacy and claims to rule. Returning to the Eastern Roman Empire of the Germans, you will remember that this ideological imperative resulted in some very contentious relationships. The Etonian dynasty was prone to some very clumsy attempts at intervention in papal affairs. Most notably, that time they promoted John XIII as Pope. You remember, that guy who, under the guise of running an anti-corruption campaign, fired aristocrats from other families in the papal bureaucracy and used the openings to build up his own family, the Crescenti, into one of the two major forces in the city. However, it should be recognized that Italy was never the sole thing going on for the German Roman emperors. Early in the Etonian dynasty, wars with West Francia and Denmark were persistent problems. Though these fronts would calm down over time, the eastern border did not. At the same time that we might be tempted to argue that the Etonian dynasty can be said to start with the defeat of the Magyars by Otto I at Lechfield, an event that sort of by its nature quieted down the east for a while, this event only really worked on quieting down forces coming out of the Pannonian Plain. In the northeast, the empire was in a constant state of low-level war against the Baltic tribes along the coast. Meanwhile, the stronger tribes to the east gradually converted to Christianity and consolidated into real kingdoms, notably Poland, Bohemia, and, by the time of the Salian dynasty, even a revived Hungary, which had precipitated out of the old Magyar hordes. Internally, the new German Empire of the old Romans had all the problems that all feudal monarchies of this era faced, with some added challenges. The emperors were really just the largest landowners among many, and had to delegate control over territory to reward their followers. Those followers, in turn, had the capacity to go into rebellions that took a lot of effort to quash, and this was a fairly regular occurrence. Pretty much every emperor or king of the German Romans had to fight at least one civil war, and depending on your definition of civil war and internal to the empire, Most of them had to fight two, if not more. However, the nobles that they were fighting in these civil wars weren't really controlling coherent princedoms either. The empire was a patchwork of overlapping feudal holdings and jurisdictions, something I will elaborate on in a few minutes when I discuss Lotharingia, but something we also discussed at length last season. Quickly, though, I must mention Saxony here. The Etonian clan had based its strength in Saxony, and while the imperial family still technically held huge swathes of land in Saxony, they had, by the time of Otto III, fully transitioned into being the rulers of a German-Roman Empire, and were no longer Saxon dukes who happened to hold sway over some other dukes as well. Part of doing this involved allowing cadet branches of the family to manage the estates in Saxony. This worked out well enough under the Etonian dynasty, but when the empire moved to the Salian dynasty, whose roots were in Franconia, tensions began to fester. While the Saxons had special privileges, and the emperors stopped in there as much as any German duchy, the Saxons would go back and forth between increasingly feeling neglected, notably in terms of their simmering conflict with the pagan Baltic tribes of the coast, and then sometimes feeling like they were getting overly put upon by the royal family when they stayed in those lands. And in any case, they were somewhat alienated from this new family, the Salians. As if all the above wasn't enough, the emperors also had to try and rule Italy, a place where feudalism manifested in an entirely different way than it did in Germany. Instead of a nested collection of landholdings, in Italy power was vested in a network of urban-focused aristocrats holding land in their local hinterlands and functioning under a regional administrative system that had been comprehensively trashed over the previous century. So we can see that the emperors had their hands full trying to manage their territory, and despite these headaches, the broad-stroke story of the German-Roman emperors in this period is actually one of gradually increasing centralization and coherence. To manage this chaos, the emperors did several things. They behaved in an itinerant fashion, moving constantly around their empire so that they could renew relationships with local aristocrats, dispense justice, check up on conditions, and generally renew the loyalty of local areas by reinforcing friendships, ties of respect and fear, and generally pressing the flesh with the local notables. A second and related measure taken was to distribute lands to members of the clergy. Because priests couldn't leave their lands to their non-existent legitimate children, episcopal lands always simply went to the next bishop or abbot, an office whose appointment was, by long custom, let's say, strongly influenced by the Emperor of Germany. This practice kept the church in Germany friendly, reduced the amount of lands controlled by major aristocrats, and acted as a way to pay the clerics who effectively staffed the German-Roman Empire's administration. Not coincidentally, the emperors also utilized church lands on their itinerant tours of the countryside, a practice that minimized resentment from the aristocracy having to pay for the emperor's large entourage, and also shows us that just because land was donated to the church, it didn't mean that the emperor couldn't still make use of it. As I mentioned earlier, attempts at creating a similar system in Italy were more of a work in progress. Several large duchies in Italy remained coherent and powerful, notably in Tuscany and Spoleto, but most of northern Italy was at this point entirely dissolved into component urban units, who had their own local traditions of doing things like electing their own bishops. That said, those elections usually happened in a context of local aristocratic politics, similar to what we saw in Rome. The emperors kept a finger on this process by working to retain loyalty amongst the nobility of these cities, and then working with these Italian bishops that were elected. Finally, there is the matter of succession. The concept of primogeniture was increasingly accepted. It was strong enough that the empire survived two minorities under Otto II and Otto III, during whose childhoods the empire was actually ruled by Adelheid and Theophanu, respectively. But there was a competing tradition. Even under the Etonians, it was taken for granted that whatever other arrangements had been made, the emperor didn't start their reign when their dad died. There had to be deliberations in a diet. A unanimous choice had to be made, and then the new emperor had to be acclaimed, and eventually crowned. Even then, the emperors usually spent a year or two touring the empire to secure assent from recalcitrants who had missed the diet and generally showing their face around the countryside. This process was mostly a managed stage play under the Ottos, but when Otto III died young and without a son, the sham deliberations of the diet became very real. More troublingly, there was no really specific rules for how the emperor was elected, a similar problem to that faced by the popes in Rome, as it happens. So it was not uncommon for competing diets to form and attempt to select different candidates as emperor. In any case, this process resulted in the eventual selection of Henry II, a man who was well regarded, but also ended up dying without an heir. So another electoral diet process started, and Conrad II of the Salian dynasty was elected. The transition to his son Henry III was smooth, however, and so the empire could be said to have resumed its centralizing tendency, a tendency strongly pushed forward by this new Henry, Henry III. Now, politics and religious hierarchies are important, but they are not everything. While all the above was happening in Germany and Italy, the Peace of God movement and the Cluniac Reform movement were emanating out of southern France, pushing complementary messages of an individual relationship with the divine, as opposed to a communal one. This growing conception of a relationship with God came not only with benefits, but also with duties and responsibilities over a person's own actions. The Cluniac Reform movement is particularly important to our story, as it sought to eliminate corruption in the church and essentially enforce monkish standards of behavior on all ordained members of the clergy. The reformers came to focus on two issues as key manifestations of corruption in the church: the lack of priestly celibacy and the practice of simony. These are seemingly simple concepts, but actually they are complicated, and their role in the larger story is important. So I'm not going to attempt a full summary here. Just know that this is there in the background as we move into the story. Suffice it to say for now that the reform movement, with its appeals to low levels of corruption, loyalty to deserving authorities, and a wide-ranging responsibility for enforcing change, was increasingly popular in Europe, though it was not a coherent movement with a single purpose and leadership. Rather, it was a movement of ideas spread by correspondence networks amongst the church hierarchy and especially amongst the monasteries, which then interacted with local conditions. As the head of a large network of sister monasteries, the abbots of Cluny had an outsized influence in the movement, but it was influence and not control. One of the places where the reform movement was most popular was in the German Roman court, which consistently allied itself with the Cluniac reformers. They saw it as their duty, as Davidic kings, to protect the church from threats external and internal, just as Charlemagne had. And so the German Roman kings and emperors saw it as their duty not only to make donations to the church, but to appoint popular, scholarly men of impeccable character as bishops. If these men happened to be relatives loyal to the crown, well, that was all the better. But in general, the Roman-German kings and emperors, after many years of trial and error, made it a point to balance their appointments to the church. They would usually be people who were educated in institutions sponsored by the crown, who had a reputation as scholars and reformers, and who thus sort of had some loyalty to the crown, but who were also popular and well-regarded. Henry III was particularly good at this, which allowed him to pursue an agenda of centralization by forcefully imposing candidates that everyone already liked, which sort of got everyone used to the idea. Podcast footnote. This kind of balancing act was not dissimilar to the balancing act that had to be undertaken in the distribution of land to the aristocracy. They couldn't give away too much, or the crown would end up weak, but they had to give away enough to keep people happy. Giving appointments to close family members would help keep areas loyal, but too many appointments went to family members, and the nobles could revolt as they felt they got locked out. And sometimes the local nobility and peasants just wouldn't respect the authority of a stranger imposed by the crown, so they had to have sort of some familiarity with the area. This is very similar to how completely random bishops or abbots posed out of nowhere by the crown might raise resistance in the abbey or the bishopric. End podcast footnote. The relationship between the papacy and the German Roman kings and emperors was complicated. Even if you didn't factor in the rising importance of the clergy in governing the empire, the Davidic claim to legitimacy that was so important to the emperors relied on a certain world view, and a big part of that rested on a partnership with the papacy. If the papacy's reputation became damaged, or if it was being controlled by an outside power, that could create major problems for the German-Roman kings and emperors. On the other hand, the local politics of Rome were very independent, and didn't appreciate outside interference, especially since interference from Germany had led to not a few civilian massacres in the previous century. Again, the emperors had to balance local actors, imperial needs, the idea of reform, and the ideal of papal independence. One thing that we haven't seen a lot of in the last few emperors is any kind of major reformist pressure in Rome itself. Given the central place of the papacy in Roman politics, it seems like theological debates were often an afterthought, at least until the Salian dynasty got involved. Indeed, almost every historian and chronicler, no matter how they feel about interference in Roman elections, acknowledges that it was the Roman German emperors who kicked off the reform movement in the papacy. Like his father, Henry III had appointed a series of reformist popes, a process that revived the prestige of the papacy and shored up the clergy's control of Rome. This effort was interestingly much more smooth than that attempted by the Etonians. I will suggest that this was aided by three factors. First of all, the Salian emperors benefited from much better human capital than the Etonians, both in terms of their Italian advisors, helping them figure out how to do things, and in terms of the people they sought to make popes. They just had a better quality of pope material. Second, by the time of Henry III, the Tusculani and the Crescenti had exhausted not only each other, but also public patience, as they fought over the papacy in a series of pitched battles that were only resolved by German-Roman emperors rolling in and putting all sides down by force. When the family started to revive, the Tusculani eventually pursued a strong alliance with the emperors as their best way to power, while the Crescenti were put down by the use of Norman mercenaries, about whom we will speak more soon. The final factor in the emperor's favor was that, while reform was generally not a huge part in the higher levels of the Italian church, it was seeping its way in. I need to mention in particular the Patria movement in Milan here, but I'm going to have to wait for a future episode to expand on that. More pertinently in Rome, we find a growing faction in the clergy built around Peter Damian and a local power broker called Hildebrand. Peter Damian, now a saint, though for obvious reasons not generally known as Saint Peter, to avoid confusion, was a charismatic philosopher, theologian, and writer, whose writings spread around the ideas of reform in Italy. An extremely able administrator, Hildebrand revived the capacity of the clerical hierarchy of the city to act in an independent fashion, just as the aristocratic hierarchy lost public support. We will get back to these men in later episodes. Okay, so much we have covered in earlier episodes. Now, as we begin our story, I'm going to have to backtrack again and into the reign of Henry III, but I think the details will pay off. Let's start in Lorraine, or as I've called it up until now, Lotharingia. You'll remember that Lotharingia is the remnant of the old Middle Kingdom from the Treaty of Verdun. In fact, Verdun was in Lotharingia. This kingdom was supposed to be the seat of the Frankish Empire, and was composed of a valuable strip of territory from the Low Countries in the north, down along the Rhine, along the Alps into Burgundy, and then down into northern Italy. The idea was that the emperor in Lotharingia would hold the balance of power between his brothers in West Francia and Eastern Francia. As you know, this idea failed almost immediately as various sons of Lothair split up the kingdom and then died, leaving bits to yet more sons who seemed to keep dying in mysterious hunting accidents, all while their uncles in eastern and western Francia rubbed their hands gleefully from the sidelines. Finally, as the Carolingian clan collapsed altogether, the successor dynasties of the eastern and western Frankish kingdoms squabbled over their territory, with eastern Franks under Otto I ultimately succeeding in establishing a more coherent kingdom first, and thus able to secure Lotharingia from the western Franks fairly definitively by the time of Henry III. Now, early on, Lotharingia became a rump state, consisting of just the territories along the Rhine. Burgundy was always somewhat of a coherent cultural entity, and it had long since gone its own way. And without Burgundy, there was, of course, no way to connect Lotharingia to Italy, even if it had wanted to stay part of the same political entity, which was never in the cards. As part of this process, Lotharingia was reduced from a kingdom to a duchy of the Eastern Kingdom. In the process of the final wars between the Western and Eastern Franks under Otto, you will remember that the tricksy Duke Gilbert kept trying to switch sides from the Eastern to the Western kings in order to secure his own independence and expand his territory. Growing tired of this game, Otto I had, after the end of the war, gone in and entirely removed the ruling dynasty of Lotharingia, which was by now starting to be called Lorraine, as the Latin and German dialects in the region merged and vulgarized. So now the Dukes of Lorraine were appointed by the Eastern Frankish king. When another rebellion occurred asking for Western Frankish aid during the reign of Otto II, a further measure was taken to stabilize the area. The duchy was split into Upper and Lower Lorraine. Now, in doing so, they followed a very annoying ancient custom that based the term upper and lower on where on the river the area was. So, Upper Lorraine was upstream from Lower Lorraine, which is fine, except the Rhine flows south to north, and so Upper Lorraine is south of Lower Lorraine. This is massively confusing to us, because we have about 1,000 years of mapping conventions behind us that put north at the top of the mouth and the south at the bottom. But that's all custom. It's not intrinsic, so we need to understand where this is coming from. And Upper Lorraine is also physically higher in elevation than Lower Lorraine, so who's in the wrong here? Words are meaningless conventions, etc., so this is what the convention is. So, now, we have Upper Lorraine in the south and Lower Lorraine in the north, and to make sure that they stayed separate, Otto named two people from two entirely different families to be the dukes. And this did serve to calm things down in terms of external influence for a long time. And so let's fast forward to the reign of Conrad II. At this time, Upper Lorraine was ruled by a guy named Gothello the Great, who was pretty good, and was one of Conrad's most loyal supporters and a skilled commander. At this time, the dynasty ruling Lower Lorraine died out, Lower Lorraine being in the north, just as a noble on the western side of the border in western Francia started threatening to create a state independent of both the western and eastern kingdoms. Needless to say, Conrad needed a steady hand on the tiller, and rather than bring in someone new, Conrad made Gothello the Duke of both duchies. Which brings us to 1044, and where this is all going to start being relevant, I promise. In that month, Gothello the Great died, by Gothello, and his son Godfrey the Bearded duly inherited Upper Lorraine, Upper being in the south. But the king, Henry III, once again worried about this entire region being in one set of hands. Things had kind of quieted down, and he was more interested in centralization than anything else. And so he didn't allow Godfrey to inherit Lower Lorraine, in the north. The chronicles tell us that when Godfrey objected to this, Henry threatened to give Lower Lorraine to Gothello II, Godfrey's younger brother, who is described in all sources as incompetent at best, and stupid and cowardly at worst. This threat caused Godfrey the Bearded to raise all of Lorraine into revolt against Henry III, which I think makes a good moment to remind ourselves of the internal structure of Eastern German Empire of the Romans. It's worth reminding ourselves at this juncture that, despite being the most stable and powerful polity in Europe at the time, the German-Roman Empire of the Romans was pretty much a mess by any modern standard. Within Germany, there were 6 dukes, who, as we've discussed, were responsible for administering justice and military leadership in their territory, though their territories could be nebulous, and within them their control was not absolute. For example, within Lower Lorraine, the cities of Metz, Verdun, Trier, and Strasbourg enjoyed varying levels of self-government, and were also at the center of massive estates controlled by their bishops. Beyond the bishops, a given duchy was subdivided into territories run by counts, and other members of the middle and lower nobility, with different families constantly struggling to rise in power, and with some families constituting a major second power base within the duchy in active competition with the dukes. I should say there are also a variety of margraves and marquis, who were essentially military rulers of border regions, also known as marks, that's the name. In practice, dukes and margraves had similar amounts of power within their territories and could potentially be more powerful in terms of active border armies at their disposal. Just to complete the picture, some of these duchies passed to family members through regular channels of inheritance, as if they were private property, and some had dukes who were supposed to be appointed, like a political office, but in practice, succession was kind of a spectrum. Even in the duchies like Lorraine, where power was theoretically appointed, powers would spend decades building a power base, and it made good sense for a king to pass power to someone who could effectively govern from day one, rather than forcing a new duke to start from scratch and deal with surly relatives of the old family hanging around. Meanwhile, just to complete the picture, the kings of the Eastern German Roman Empire maintained the theoretical right to depose dukes even in duchies with agreed succession if those dukes rebelled or committed a crime of some kind. So, in practice, almost all these duchies had second or even third families with some claim to rule, all with lands in multiple territories outside the duchy, so they were real hard to get rid of, all constantly in a state of low-level warfare attempting to get what they felt was their due, with the king/emperor standing as the final arbiter of these conflicts, with his massive personal army backing the justice system. While all the emperors had used this position as arbiter to secure their rule, Henry III in particular had been using his position to centralize power into his own hands, more than your average bird. He would ensure one family, then another, was humbled and ultimately depended on him for lands and patronage, and unable to function independently for fear of the others. This allowed the emperor to do things like impose reformist church leaders as bishops and even popes, something he regarded as his duty, after all. While the creation of a central state that isn't constantly about to explode into civil war seems kind of a good thing to us, the various noble families Henry humbled obviously had some different feelings about things. Obviously, one of those with some feelings at this moment was Godfrey the Bearded. Let's get back to Godfrey. Henry dealt with Godfrey's rebellion by essentially raising a number of opponents against Godfrey, and Godfrey dealt with them fairly successfully in a series of battles. However, Godfrey had to maintain a balance here. He was using force to take and hold territory, but he didn't have the power to take on the emperor on equal terms. And so, following the standard pattern of medieval warfare, this revolt was as much a protracted negotiation as an out-and-out conflict. There'd be a skirmish, there'd be a battle, Godfrey would win, and then diplomats would go back and forth trying to secure some sort of settlement. Settlements would be entered, nothing would be resolved, wars would start again. Mostly, Godfrey was actually fighting Henry's local representatives, like the Bishop of Verdun or the new Duke of Lower Lorraine, and while battles happened, Godfrey had to be careful not to cross too many lines, lest he alienate his local supporters. For example, after defeating the Bishop of Verdun and sacking the city, Godfrey agreed several years later to pay to rebuild the cathedral and to make things right with the local populace as well as the emperor and the bishop. And there was never a time where Godfrey took his forces outside of the Lorraines to try and topple the king. Meanwhile, the king had other concerns in the east and south and didn't feel the need to bring the entire royal force to bear. If he had, he probably would have just wiped Godfrey out. But as a result of the distraction of the king and the circumspection of Godfrey, the result was that the war was a series of skirmishes and sieges, mostly pitting Godfrey against cities, bishops, vassals, and local powers, and generally vassals of his own theoretical territories, but who had some beef with him or had more loyalty to the emperor than to the duchy. Eventually, Godfrey's rebellion sort of just ran out of steam, and he had settled into a stalemate with Gerard, the most recent Duke of Lower Lorraine. Ultimately, Godfrey made peace with Henry and Gerard and the various bishops, and things kind of calmed down. But again, none of the grievances had actually been settled between the parties to this conflict. In fact, new grievances had been generated. That's when Godfrey came up with a cunning plan. He needed a way to find the power to break the stalemate, and so in 1054, Godfrey tried to get married to Beatrice of Canossa. Who is Beatrice of Canossa? Beatrice was actually Godfrey's cousin, which is gross. But in any case, she originally came from Upper Lorraine, and as such was from that other family that ultimately died out before Othello took over. But that's not why Godfrey was interested. Obviously, he was interested in her huge tracts of land. That land was not in Lorraine. Rather, this was the land she controlled as a result of her marriage to her first husband, Boniface III of Canossa, Duke of Tuscany. Who is Boniface III, Duke of Tuscany? Now, some of you may remember this guy, but I mentioned him real quickly a bunch of episodes back, so let's give him his due here. Tuscany has always been a rich and coherent duchy in Italy, but like the others, it was a bit broken down by the time Conrad II came to town. Boniface was from one of the leading families of the region, but wasn't much more than that until he threw his lot in with Conrad. He based his power around the fortress of Canossa, deep in the Apennine Mountains, but he had managed to use that base to take over some key cities and trading routes. A canny military leader and politician, Boniface supported Conrad in the many civil wars that followed the establishment of the Salian dynasty in Germany. Growing in power and influence, with lands gained as part of each victory, Boniface became the Salian dynasty's guy on the ground in Italy. Not the only one, but definitely one of the main pillars of their rule. Eventually, he was made the Duke of his native Tuscany, which made him the pillar of their rule. By the time Henry III came to power, Boniface was the Duke of Tuscany, absurdly rich, and one of, if not the largest landowners in the empire apart from Henry himself, and for most of Henry's reign, Boniface remained a very loyal vassal. All was not rosy, however. Henry III's policy of imposing reformist popes eventually got in between the two men. You will remember from the most recent episodes that Boniface had supported three-time papal incumbent Benedict IX, but was forced by Henry's order to forcibly depose and remove Benedict in favor of Damasus II. This Boniface did, but probably wasn't weeping too much when Damasus II mysteriously died a short time later. However, when the charismatic and popular Leo IX came to town, Boniface saw the writing on the wall and joined up with his reformist agenda, despite, you know, being somewhat notorious himself for cheating the church out of lands and revenues. What you gonna do? This brought the entire family into the reformist orbit for the first time, and patched up open hostilities between the Duke and the Emperor. Despite these outward appearances, however, the list of enemies of Boniface was probably as long as his friends. I mean, he had spent the entire last couple of decades beating up various people in Italy and taking their lands. And he even did that up in the Alps and across the Alps. He was all over the place. And our records indicate numerous instances of him using extreme brutality to secure lands and revenues. And he was constantly coming up with new fees to squeeze from his vassals. So it isn't a huge surprise that he was assassinated while hunting in 1052. The assassin was never caught, so the perpetrator will never be known, though many have subsequently blamed Henry III due to their deteriorating relationship. That narrative is somewhat borne out by subsequent events, but their disagreements up to that point seem pretty minor to do a murder over. Chroniclers of the time are just as likely to point the finger at a disgruntled noble, which seems plausible if you take the event in isolation. As I have said, later events definitely make Henry a suspect, and maybe Henry was just concerned that Boniface had acquired too much power. But also, maybe Henry thought Boniface had killed Damasus. We just don't know, and the sources that we do have are extremely biased. In any case, I do believe that the Canossa clan came to blame Henry at some point. But of course, whether that's accurate or, you know, influenced by later events, who knows. Getting back to Beatrice. So she and Boniface seem to have had a happy enough marriage for the time, according to the testimony of her children later. Those children were Beatrice, Frederick, and Matilda. The daughter, Beatrice, died in 1053, and I haven't been able to pin down the circumstances. I honestly really think that's an important bit of information for this story, and it's really annoying that we don't have it. But then it was a busy year. In any case, with the death of her husband and probably daughter in rapid succession, Beatrice was left in the unenviable position of having to stand as regent for Frederick, her young son. Locally, the many sub-vassals of the family were sure to take advantage of the situation to break away from ducal control, and the family was unlikely to get much help from Henry. Even if he didn't murder her husband, Henry hardly had any major incentives to maintain a large independent power block within the empire that could rival his own. In fact, he was much more likely to take over as a ward and give away large chunks of the territory as dowries while he married off Beatrice and Matilda, eventually giving Frederick whatever was left. So this is where we come back to Godfrey and his attraction to Beatrice's huge tracts of land. According to Spike, this match was arranged by the Pope to protect her from Henry, but honestly that doesn't make any sense at all. The Pope at this time was Leo IX, who, while certainly an earnest reformer and a renowned moralist, was also a German who had been selected by an assembly at Worms. Given how everyone in the empire was related and correspondence was very common, it seems more likely to me that these two powerful nobles, who were adults and capable of making their own rational choices, arranged it on their own. In any case, what we do know is that Beatrice turned to Godfrey the Bearded and arranged a marriage. I think we can see how this made sense to Beatrice and Godfrey. As we said, this match would give Godfrey the power he needed to break any future deadlocks with the Emperor. For Beatrice, Godfrey was someone with enough military power and experience to help Beatrice hold down her duchy for her son. Historians have debated if she knew this would cheese off Henry, but to me, that's a concern that goes away if she thought Henry had arranged Boniface's death. Which isn't a thing we know for sure, but this choice makes way more sense if she did think that, which I know is circular reasoning, but work with me here. Of course, by these same tokens, I think we can also see why Henry would be sort of unhappy about this situation. Godfrey, a dubious vassal at the best of times, was going to more than double his effective holdings in terms of size and would take over some of the wealthiest parts of the empire in the process of marrying the widow of a man Henry had possibly just assassinated. Even if Henry hadn't had beef with Beatrice yet, The union of two of the most powerful families in the empire was not going to be seen kindly by an emperor who spent his entire reign centralizing his power. Luckily for Henry, the law allowed him to veto marriages within the royal inner circle, a group that included Beatrice. With the law on his side and seeing the threat as grave, Henry marched quickly into Italy with his royal army, captured Beatrice and Matilda before Godfrey could arrive, and made them wards of the royal court. Prisoners, essentially, but nicer. It's not entirely clear what happened to Frederick or when. The one thing we do know is that he wasn't with his mother and sister. One story is that Frederick was summoned to appear at court by Henry, which he refused, but then he died of natural causes before anyone could react. In this version, the fact that the two young siblings died at around the same time suggests that some sort of illness may have been going around Italy, and the Canossa family just had some bad luck. The story told by Pike is similar, that Frederick certainly died around this time, and there's no definitive proof of why or how. This is probably the most responsible stance for a historian to take. We just don't know. But that relies on us discounting all the chroniclers who had something to say about it. The third story, which is in several chronicles, although they are of course very biased, is that Frederick was, in fact, captured and died shortly thereafter in prison. If that's the real story, then if the Canossa clan didn't have a beef with Henry before, they sure did now. I think that, regardless of the specifics, we can say that around this time, her husband died. Two of Beatrice's children also died, including her male heir. This left her in a bad position. Godfrey and Beatrice attempted to get married, but Beatrice and Matilda were arrested. Inevitably, Godfrey went back into open revolt, but without any more power on his side than the last time he'd revolted, and so it had the same results. Meanwhile, Henry convened a diet, at which he condemned Beatrice and Godfrey, declared Boniface's lands to be without an owner, and took control of them for himself. From a legal standpoint, he was in the right several times over. When the male line died out, it was often the prerogative of kings to take them over and reassign them. While certainly beneficial for the king and the patronage system, it also kept locals and relatives from starting blood feuds during a power vacuum. The fact that Godfrey and Beatrice had essentially tried to commit an act of rebellion by marrying without royal consent just made Henry's confiscation that much more legally sound. Incidentally, at the same diet, Henry rearranged power in Italy to function in the absence of the strong local hand Boniface had provided. Filling the vacuum was the Pope. Yet another reason that the Pope had probably not helped arrange the marriage. Henry then arranged for other major Italian noble families to be more closely tied to the imperial family through marriages and alliances and that kind of thing, and then headed home. Beatrice and her daughter were left as wards of the court, partially as a punishment and partly because they now lacked a male protector, and it was the duty of the king to care for widows and orphans. Nice how that works out sometimes. While the Canossa women probably had some fairly grim feelings about him by this point, Henry probably thought he had taken this particular threat off the chessboard, and probably felt rather fat and sassy about the whole situation. Podcast footnotes. This is a long one. There's a few comments I need to make here about the legalities of this whole situation, but broadly speaking, we can put this under the heading of property rights of women, but also under the heading of commentary on my sources. Last time out, I mentioned Tuscan Countess, The Life and Extraordinary Times of Matilda of Canossa by Michelle K. Spike. I mentioned that this was going to be a major source, but that I hadn't read it yet. Well, I have read most of it now, and a short conversation about the work is needed. I probably should have put this up front, but this episode was already half introduction and housekeeping, and I wanted to just get on with it. Plus, I knew I could just talk about it here. This book is a very popular English-language popular history of Matilda de Canossa. As with many popular histories, including this show, it is not written by a historian. Michelle Spike is a writer and professor of law, which, to be fair, gives her just as many transferable skills in research as, say, being an urban planner would. Certainly it's no worse than being a journalist, the usual source of popular histories. Moreover, her husband, John Spike, is an art historian, with whom she has collaborated on several books. Which is to say that she's not a history-writing neophyte. She's got skills, and she's got some background. All the same, this is not your usual historical literature overview. Spike presents the story as something of a travelogue, intertwining the story of the Canossa family with her own travels around Italy, between various luxurious villas, apparently, to find traces of places where Matilda had personally been. I'm going to hold off on discussing her primary thesis in the name of avoiding spoilers, but suffice it to say that there are many places where I have some issues with Spike's narrative. Though I do think her thesis is interesting and plausible, but you'll see. Some key details that are major topics of dispute are quickly brushed over by her without comment, and there are some points that I feel are inaccurate, and of course the biggest sin of all, she uses endnotes instead of footnotes. Put in like a dun-dun-dun. You all know my fondness for footnotes, but I should be clear here about why endnotes are evil and must be destroyed. From a reader's perspective, I consider it highly dubious that people simply stop reading and start flipping around to the end of the book to try and find the note. Probably dubious that your average reader would read a footnote, but the idea that they would then flip through the book is absurd. Since they are not doing that, we have to hope that at best they go consult the notes after the end of each chapter. Like, they finish the chapter and then flip to the end of the book and read the endnotes. But then, of course, they may not have noticed, when they were reading through the chapter of contents in detail, that there were endnotes. They may have just assumed that there were no notes. So, maybe they are expected to read the book, then find that there are endnotes, and do, like, a second read of the book. They go through the different notes, they flip back, and then they flip back again. A more detailed study. Right. Okay. Theoretically, the defense of endnotes that I have heard before is that the notes are only there for academic readers who are going to put in that level of work, and using endnotes helps the pages look more aesthetically pleasing for the popular audience. And to be fair, this is a very pretty book. But I think ultimately endnotes are more often than not a way to hide important points away from credulous readers. Why have them at all if they're going to be hidden? Anytime I see the use of endnotes, I become incredibly suspicious. That said, I should give Spike her due. This is an absolutely charming book. It's a fun read, and if it's somewhat more influenced by romance novels and travel writing than your average history book, well, I can't argue with the results. And as with most genre fiction, the trashy reputation of romance novels is widely overstated. Live a little, fellas. Feel some feelings. Now then, the point. The point of this whole review is just to pick at one statement made repeatedly by Spike that I very much disagree with. Spike says on numerous occasions that, due to Salic law, women could not inherit or hold property on their own, and that this is why the Canossa women were so vulnerable here. She also talks about their unruly vassals being likely to not respect them, but she uses Salic law as a shorthand for why. The thing is, it is dubious at best that Salic law had anything to do with the lands held by the Canossa family for the very simple reason that their lands were in Italy. The Salic law was adopted by the Merovingian Franks in the year 511 when they lived at the mouth of the Rhine in what is now Belgium. We are currently discussing Italy in the 1040s. The laws of the Merovingians were largely rolled over into the Carolingian Empire, an empire that did conquer Italy. But local kingdoms had their own legal traditions, and anyway, that empire fell apart a century ago. Northern Italy was notable for continuing to use Lombard law, which was a local variation of late antique Roman law with some German stuff thrown into the mix. The city of Rome explicitly rejected all this stuff, and used Roman law, and rejected any other legal tradition. We've been over this before, but as a refresher, under Lombard law, women were under perpetual wardship of men, but were considered to have property at some level in terms of dowries that followed the women and didn't just subsume into her husband's property. In addition, there were extremely strong taboos against harming or disrespecting women. Furthermore, under late antique Roman law, women absolutely could, and did, own property. If there was a senior male relative, they were expected to defer to the paterfamilias in managing the territory, but widows absolutely had the ability to manage their estates, even if they had sons, provided they were not yet adults. And even once the sons came of age, a widow could control her dowry until her death. We have seen numerous women, in Italy in particular, take leading roles in government. The strongest claim of the German Roman Empire to own Italy came through Adelaide of Italy, you will remember. The Germans may not have wanted to see it that way, but it was Adelaide that brought the Italians in, not Odo's legal gymnastics. So why, at this point, was the Canossa family essentially powerless due to Salic law? Why were the vassals making trouble due to a legal system from 500 years before? They weren't. And yet there is the fact that the Canossa family women were essentially in a gilded prison in Henry's court, so why was Henry in such an advantageous position over them? Well, it is because they were women, but it's not due to Salic law. Sorry if it seems like I'm splitting hairs here, but this bugs me. This bugs me because everyone thinks of Salic law because of Henry V of England and Shakespeare, but it has nothing to do with essentially anything. Anyway, so why were they being held prisoner? Well, firstly, because Henry wanted it that way, and he had the army, and he had physically taken them prisoner, and no one was going to rescue them. If they had evaded him, it's very dubious that he would have been able to have them completely at his mercy the way he did. Yes, them being women made their leadership more difficult in many ways, and them running around independent might have been harder, but the fact is that that's kind of as a result of the specific situation they were in, and not the legal tradition. Boniface had held his territories together with brutality and terror. The Canossa family would have had trouble stabilizing their lands even if Frederick had lived, not because Frederick was a woman or something, but because none of them were set to be military leaders who could burn people alive in a church, something that Boniface had done one time. And Henry had no reason to encourage those lands to stabilize. You know, no one was going to come to their side and help them. Now, this isn't to say that there was no legal reason that this was all going on. Like I just said, them being women did create certain opportunities under German law. When male lines died out, it was often the case, under numerous legal traditions, for the sovereign to step in and take over. I talked about this before. And the attempted marriage was an act of rebellion. But I doubt that would have gotten much traction if Beatrice had had the time to secure her rule and had not been captured. It's not like Henry was going to send in the medieval cops and say, There were certainly plenty of other women who operated on their own, especially in Italy. Still, all that said, being women did make them more vulnerable. It's just not as open and shut as Spike made it seem. Given the fact that they could theoretically still take back their land, you might wonder at this point why he kept the Canossa women alive. Well, because they were women. There were many taboos against harming noble women in pretty much every legal tradition and cultural tradition in operation at this point, be it Roman or Frank or Lombard, whatever. Nobles in general were very rarely killed openly. It could be killed in battle, but if you captured someone, you were supposed to, like, forgive them and, you know, make friends and shed some tears and cry about it together and, you know, have manly hugs. Things like that. You know, the fact that someone who could actually turn around and go into a rebellion again and kill you, those people were supposed to be shown mercy. The idea that you would not show mercy to women who were, you know, a protected class under Christianity, you know, is completely out of question. Certainly people were assassinated and things like that. And what happened behind closed doors in terms of torture, well, you know, no one really cared about that. But women were supposed to be not harmed and respected, especially noble women. More prosaically, they represented potentially useful bargaining chips. As his vassals, he could absolutely claim them as wards, and that let him control their lands until he could marry them off to reward loyal vassals with Canossa family lands, albeit broken up into dowries. Fortunately or unfortunately, that didn't happen, as we will see. End podcast footnote. In this stage of his kingship, Henry III seemed to be everywhere. He interfered with the succession in Poland, Hungary, and Bohemia, leaving a staunch ally on the throne of Bohemia, a neutral king in Poland, and an enemy in Hungary. He undermined one of his strongest supporters in Saxony, Bernard II, when he supported a bishop over the Lord in a land dispute, leaving Bernard on the brink of revolt. Henry narrowly avoided assassination at the hands of a coup attempt. Luckily, his supporters caught wind of the plan, but those implicated included key figures in the Welf family. The Welfs, a cadet branch of a Burgundian family that you will recall produced one of the queens of Louis the Pious, they were major players now in Bavaria and the Carinthian regions, near the Alps. They actually controlled several passes, which made them very important. Finally, while Henry had seen fit to go down into Italy, he had not really dealt with the fledgling Norman territories, which were in the process of coalescing into a kingdom, as we will see in a future episode. And so it was under these circumstances that Henry III died, which was not really ideal. The death of Henry III affected many people, but possibly the person most impacted in the long run was the one person I have not yet really discussed, a person who is rather important to our story, which is to say, Henry's son and future star of this show, Henry IV. Say hello to Henry IV. We have not really discussed Henry, because Henry IV was six. I mean, that is to say, Henry was a little boy at the time of his father's death, which makes this succession thing very interesting. Born on the 11th of November in 1050, Henry was the son of Henry III by his second wife, Agnes of Poitou. This birth was a huge relief for Henry III, since up until that time he had only had daughters, and as we know, Salic law said that women who inherited property immediately burst into flames. Henry III rapidly moved to secure his heir into the succession. In 1051, Henry called a gathering of the nobility in Cologne, where he presented his boy and made everyone swear that he would succeed his father. The actual wording of the oath has sparked volumes of discussion by historians, as the nobles swore to follow the baby king specifically if he proved to be a just king. While historians are gonna historian, and while that turned out to be, you know, ominous wording in retrospect, at the time I doubt either Henry III or his leading nobles saw this as putting some sort of get-out-of-loyalty-free card into the legal system. The key thing was that Henry IV had been declared king in a diet. Well, pooping himself, presumably. You know, he was one. Apart from being declared king while still a literal infant, we know very little about King Henry IV's childhood before the age of six. This is not unusual. We know very little about children in general in this period. Chroniclers generally only tend to talk about people once they start doing notable things. And while first steps and using the big girl chair are notable achievements when you're an exhausted parent, it generally doesn't make the news no matter how many notices you send. That said, we do have one unexpected source for this period. Matilda de Canossa was living at court in the months before Henry III's death, and as such was being raised with the other court children. Matilda would go on to essentially dictate an autobiography much later in life. Unfortunately, all she says about the several years she knew young Henry at court is that she didn't like him very much. She doesn't give us much detail, but she does say that he had been a cruel child, constantly reprimanded, and called him imperious and arrogant, and said that he made her life miserable. Of course, this view of things may have been colored by subsequent events, but I do think it's fair to say there was no love lost between Matilda, who was essentially being kept as a prisoner, right after her father and possibly her brother were assassinated by Henry's dad. And we're talking about a 5-year-old girl and a 6-year-old boy, both of whom are renowned for having cooties. If they didn't like each other much, there's plenty of reasons that could have happened without Henry being some sort of 9th century Veruca Salt. Of course, these are all the kids of rich nobles. They were probably all spoiled and insufferable by my standards, but I do think Matilda's statement also needs to be read in the light of later conflict, and thus can be taken with a grain of, well, salt. In any case, Henry is dead. Long live King Henry. This is where the threads of our narrative really come together. As it happens, the Pope, Victor II, was in residence with the court when Henry died. So was the 6-year-old Henry IV, his mother, Agnes, and Beatrice of Canossa, and her daughter, Matilda. As such, all but one of our dramatis personae were in the German court when Henry died, and we will come back to Hildebrand next episode. So let us set our scene. For those of you familiar with regencies from other studies, you know the broad strokes of the dangers involved. At the most basic level, a regency implies people who do not have the king's legitimacy acting in the king's name. So all the challenges of monarchical power are still there, but you also have a lack of legitimacy, and usually, a lack of a singular leader who's able to make and enforce decisions. Just to spell out the difficulties, I reviewed earlier in this episode how kings of the German Roman Empire were often itinerant, so they could show their face around the country and resolve disputes between nobles or lead armies in battle. Well, King Baby and the Regent's Brigade would struggle to do any of these things. Leading armies was, of course, right out, and it would be hard to establish ties of friendship with local power brokers if the king was busy potty training. As far as resolving disputes between nobles, well, those nobles made up the Regency Council. So, regencies have all these problems, but with none of the legitimacy that comes from being kings or some sort of settled political system. It's clear to everyone that the regents are acting in the name of the king, and that they don't have whatever kind of divine or legal sanction a given society believes in. To make it work, you need buy-in to the expedient of the council from all the royal allies, but it is those same allies who have plenty of incentives to shut each other out of patronage, or to loot the monarchy for resources and rights and leave the king without power even when he does come of age. Luckily for the German Empire of the Romans, they were not entirely in the dark here. While a regency would never have worked in the old Frankish kingdoms, and the attempts to do so in the wake of the empire's collapse can only be described as slow-motion tragedies, enough legal precedent existed to give some guidance. Children were raised by their mothers, so when a child is set to inherit but is too young, the mother becomes the child's primary guardian, usually with the assistance of a male family member or member of the clergy. There was also recent historical precedent. While regencies never happened in the Frankish Empire, in the new German Empire of the Romans, there had been two successful regencies in a row, fairly recently. The regencies of St. Adelaide and Imperatrix Theophanu were remembered as times of peace, prosperity, and relative cultural progress, followed by smooth transitions to rule by well-regarded emperors. So, there's a track record here. In this case, then, the primary regent was Agnes of Poitou. The mother of the king and a woman related to royalty throughout Europe, she had her own connections. In addition to that, she had the benefit of all of her husband's seasoned and loyal advisors. Most notable of these advisors was Pope Victor II, a man who was most certainly not just a fancy hat with legs. He had been a German bishop before his election to the papacy, and in that role was one of Henry III's most trusted advisors. As a reformist pope, of course, he had legitimacy in spades. Henry III had emphasized through his reign the emperor's role as God's vicar on earth, anointed with holy oil, but everyone knew that it was still the pope who crowned the king. As such, a regency led by Agnes and Victor had every chance of succeeding because their decisions were not just in the king's name, but had holy sanction. The regency also could boast the steady guiding hand of a whole group of trusted companions of the old king. A key figure among those companions, though one slightly further afield, was Abbot Hugh of Cluny. The current spiritual leader of the reform movement, Hugh was Henry IV's godfather, was a key supporter of the emperor's, a friend of Henry III. Unfortunately, he also lived in France, and so his support was more in the realm of moral support and ideological cover, provided by the writing of letters. Still, not nothing. Other key advisors were Otto of Northheim, a Saxon noble, Archbishop Anno of Cologne, Conrad III of Carinthia, Rudolf of Rheinfelden, and Berthold of Zuringen, amongst others. One last group of people to mention here are the ministeriales. The origins and exact meaning of this term are hard to nail down, but essentially they seem to have been similar to the sergeants and castellans of France or the bailiffs and reeves of England. Essentially, these were people who were the meeting point between the nobility and the peasantry. As the people who actually had local leadership roles and actually collected rents and taxes, these folks occupied an important position in medieval society, but it was a liminal position. They were all probably commoners initially, but because of their power and importance to the noble families, there was a lot of upward pressure on them. Essentially, over the course of centuries, their position could move up or down in status. The nobility of England found ways to keep the reeves as commoners. In France, though, the castellans, who did a similar job, became minor nobility. In both places, sergeants and bailiffs took on more military and law enforcement roles that did not necessarily connote nobility, but had very officially connotations. All of which is to say, ministeriales were people who came from humble backgrounds, but who did administrative work. Many sources insist that they were unfree, but as we've covered in this show, the difference between free and unfree in the early Middle Ages, while important to an individual, may not be entirely clear in the records across the remove of centuries. And we really shouldn't imagine some kind of janissary or slave soldier here. We're talking about unfree in the sense of them being, like, technically serfs, not slaves. Although, of course, as we talked about in the episode on slavery, that distinction itself is kind of muddy. The important thing about the ministeriales was that they were given important functions in the court and the government of the empire. Mostly this meant that they were non-noble soldiers or servants around the various royal properties, But by the time of Henry IV's regency, the chroniclers all tell some version of a story about the government relying greatly on ministeriales to do numerous administrative functions, up to and including managing the education of Henry IV. The key thing to understand about the ministeriales is that their families were not big players in the empire's political scene. They had education, they had capability, but they owed their advancement and place in the world to their position, which they owed to whomever had hired them, usually the royal family, and they could be relied upon for their loyalty. So given this situation, it shouldn't be surprising that upon Henry III's death, Pope Victor gathered up a gang of ministeriales and sent them to gather the nobility immediately. There the nobles were encouraged to reaffirm their loyalty to the infant king, in a ceremony that avoided the necessity of an entirely new election and coronation. Beyond time efficiency reasons, an election and coronation was a process that could have well disinherited Henry IV. Having taken decisive action on this issue and established its authority, this regency looked like it was on solid ground and off to a good start. All the same, it was still a regency, and so the order of the day was making deals and patching up disputes wherever possible. Bernard II was placated in Saxony, though to be fair, he was elderly and died soon after. More notably, three entire duchies were given to members of the royal inner circle to try and retain their loyalty. These were the duchies of Bavaria, Carinthia, and Swabia. With that done, Agnes and Victor turned their attention to Godfrey and the simmering war in Lorraine. The parties to that dispute all met, and a deal was struck. Victor seems to have felt that a revived Canossa polity could help the crown considerably in Italy, just as Boniface had done, and that was sorely needed. So Godfrey was finally allowed to marry Beatrice. He remained legally deprived of his lands in Lorraine, so he didn't get off scot-free, and they avoided the nightmare scenario of him becoming as big a landowner as the emperor or anything like that. But in return for loyalty to the regency, he was put in charge of all of Boniface's old lands, and to sweeten the deal, he was also made Duke of Spoleto, which gives him a lot of power anyway. This made him an extremely powerful lord, but gave him a whole lot of very difficult lands to consolidate. Possibly the idea was to buy him off with a complicated gift that would keep him loyal, but also very busy. Agnes and Victor then turned their attention to Hungary. So, with the backing of Agnes and the ministeriales, with all the major nobles placated, the regency seemed to be off to a great start and ready to tackle Hungary. And then, in 1057, Pope Victor II died, and everything started to come apart. With Camel Sherman PT 17, 60 and cloudy. I go slow compared to modernity. I'm a hummingbee, sweater, weather, and hugs and drugs and movies. The baby eyes is growing.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.